Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info. It's difficult for those of us who are naturally rebellious to understand God's will. But if we have our eyes and hearts open, we can find out what it is. That's what the Bible accounts of Yitzhak, Ishmael, Yaakov, and Esau teach us. The following is a recorded discussion of the Torah section Toldot, which means generations. It covers Genesis chapter 25, verse 19, through chapter 28, verse 9. Hallel Fellowship teacher Daniel explores the beginning of Yitzhak's account in earnest. The battle over Esau's birthright and blessing reveals how the Spirit of God transforms us by helping us battle our fleshly clinging to our old ways of life.
We're in Genesis, starting chapter 25. We get to study Jacob and Esau a little while. This is Parashat Toldot, which starts in Genesis 25. It's starting in verse 19, and that goes through chapter 28, verse 9. So Genesis 25, verse 19. And these are the offspring of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, from Padan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean, as a wife for himself. Isaac entreated the Lord opposite his wife, because she was barren. The Lord allowed himself to be entreated by him, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children agitated within her, and she said, "If so, why am I thus?" And she inquired of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two regimes from your insides shall be separated. The might shall pass from one regime to the other. The elder shall serve the younger." When her term to bear grew full, then behold, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red, entirely like a hairy mantle. So they named him Esau. After that, his brother emerged with his hand grasping onto the heel of Esau. So he called his name Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. The lads grew up, and Esau became one who knows hunting, a man of the field. But Jacob was a wholesome man, abiding in tents. Isaac loved Esau, for game was in his mouth, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Jacob simmered a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was exhausted. Esau said to Jacob, "Pour into me now some of that very red stuff, for I am exhausted." He therefore called his name Edom. Jacob said, "Sell as this day your birthright to me." Esau said, "Look, I am going to die, so what use to me is a birthright?" Jacob said, "Swear to me as this is day." He swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and got up and left. Thus Esau spurned the birthright. Chapter 26. There was a famine in the land, aside from the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, to Gerar. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not descend to Egypt. Dwell in the land that I shall indicate to you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your offspring I will give all these lands, and establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will increase your offspring like the stars of the heavens, and will give your offspring all these lands, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your offspring. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and observed my safeguards, my commandments, my decrees, and my Torahs." So Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say, "My wife, lest the men of the place kill me because of Rebekah, for she is fair to look upon." It came to pass, as his days were lengthened, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, gazed down through the window and saw, behold, Isaac was jesting with his wife, Rebekah. Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "But look, she is your wife. How could you say she's my sister?" Isaac said to him, "Because I said that I would be killed because of her." Abimelech said, "What is this that you have done to us? One of the people has nearly lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." Abimelech then warned all the people, saying, "Whoever molests this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Now Isaac sowed in that land, and in that year he reaped 100-fold. Thus the Lord blessed him. The man became great and kept becoming greater until he was very great. He had acquired flocks and herds and many enterprises, and the Philistines envied him. All the wells his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines stopped up and filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you have become much mightier than we." So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and dwelled there. Isaac dug anew the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. The Philistines had stopped them up after Abraham's death. He called them by the same names his father had called them. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of fresh water. The herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of that well Ezek, because they involved themselves with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it also. So he called its name Sitna. He relocated from there and dug another well. They did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rabot, and said, "For now, the Lord has granted us ample space, and we can be fruitful in the land." When he went up from there to Beersheba, the Lord appeared to him that night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Fear not, for I am with you. I will bless you and increase your offspring because Abraham, my servant." He built an altar there and invoked the Lord by name, and there he pitched his tent, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. Abimelech went to him from Gerar with a group of his friends and Pichol, the general of his legion. Isaac said to him, "Why have you come to me? You hate me and drove me away from you." And they said, "We have indeed seen the Lord has been with you. So we said, let the oath between ourselves now be between us and you. Let us make a covenant with you. If you do evil with us, just as we have not molested you, and just as we have done with you only good and sent you away in peace, now you, blessed of the Lord." He made them a feast, and they ate and drank. They awoke early in the morning and swore to one another. Then Isaac saw them off, and they departed from him in peace. And it was on that very day that Isaac's servant came and told him about the well they had dug. And he said to them, "We have found water." He named it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba until this very day. When Esau was 40 years old, he took a wife, Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basmat, daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a source of spiritual rebellion to Isaac and to Rebekah. Chapter 27. And it came to pass, when Isaac had become old and his eyes dimmed from seeing, that he summoned Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son," he said to him, "Here I am." He said, "See now, I have aged. I know not the day of my death. Now sharpen, if you please, your gear, your sword and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then make me delicacies such as I love, and bring it to me, and I will eat, so that my soul may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game and to bring. But Rebekah said to Jacob, her son, saying, "Behold, I heard your father speaking to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game and make me delicacies to eat, and I will bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death.' So now, my son, heed my voice, that which I command you. Go now to the flock and fetch me from there 2 choice young kids of the goats, and I will make delicacies for you, for your father, as he loves. Then bring it to your father, and he shall eat, so that he may bless you before his death." Jacob replied to Rebekah, his mother, brother Esau is a hairy man. I'm smooth-skinned. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall be a mocker in his eyes, and I will thus bring myself a curse rather than a blessing. But his mother said to him, "Your curse be upon me, my son. Only heed my voice and fetch them for me." So he went, he fetched, and brought to his mother. And his mother made delicacies as his father loved. Rebekah then took her elder son Esau's clean garments, which were with her in the house, and clothed Jacob, her son. With the skins of goat kids, she covered his arms and his smooth-skinned neck. She placed the delicacies and the bread which she had made into the hand of her son Jacob. He came to his father and said, "Father," he said, "here I am." "Who are you, my son?" Jacob asked his father. Jacob said to his father, "It is I, Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Rise up, please. Sit and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you were so quick to find my son?" And he said, "Because the Lord your God arranged it for me." And Isaac said to Jacob, "Come close, if you please, so I can feel you, my son. Are you indeed my son Esau or not?" So Jacob drew close to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are Esau's hands." But he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like the hands of Esau's brother. So he blessed him. He said, "You are indeed my son Esau." And he said, "I am. Serve me and let me eat of my son's game, that my soul may bless you." So he served him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come close if you please, and kiss me, my son." So he drew close and kissed him. He smelled the fragrance of his garments and blessed him and said, "See, the fragrance of my son is like the fragrance of a field, which the Lord has blessed. And may God give you the dew of the heavens and the fatness of the earth and abundant grain and wine. Peoples will serve you and regimes will prostrate themselves to you. Be a lord to your kinsmen, and your mother's sons will prostrate themselves to you. Cursed be they who curse you, and blessed be they who bless you." And it was when Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely left the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came back from his hunt. He too made delicacies and brought them to his father. He said to his father, "Let my father rise and eat of his son's gains, that your soul will bless me." Isaac his father said to him, "Who are you?" He said, "I am your firstborn son, Esau." Then Isaac trembled in a very great perplexity and said, Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? And I partook of all when you had not yet come, and I blessed him. Indeed, he shall remain blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he cried out an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, father." But he said, "Your brother came with cleverness and took your blessing." And he said, "Is it because his name was called Jacob that he outwitted me these two times? He took away my birthright, and see now he took away my blessing." And then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, a lord have I made him over you, and all his kin have I given him as servants. With grain and wine have I supported him. And for you, where? What can I do, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, father? Bless me too, father." Esau raised his voice and he wept. So Isaac's father answered and said to him, "Behold, of the fatness of the earth shall be your dwelling, and of the dew of the heavens from above. By your sword you shall live, but your brother you shall serve. Yet it shall be that when you are aggrieved, you may cast off his yoke from upon your neck." Now Esau harbored hatred toward Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau thought, "May the days of mourning for my father draw near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." When Rebekah was told the words of her older son Esau, she sent and summoned Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself regarding you to kill you. So now, my son, heed my voice and arise. Flee to my brother Laban in Haran, and remain with him a short while until your brother's wrath subsides, until your brother's anger against you subsides and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send you and bring you from there. Why should I bereave of both of you on the same day?" Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am disgusted with my life on account of the daughters of Het. If Jacob marries a wife of the daughters of Het like these, the daughters of the land, what is life to me?" So Isaac summoned Jacob and blessed him. He instructed him and said to him, "Do not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take a wife from there, from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And may El Shaddai bless you, and make you fruitful, and make you numerous. May you be a congregation of peoples. May he grant you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your offspring with you, that you may possess the land of your sojourns, which God gave to Abraham." So Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went toward Padan Aram, to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Aramean, brother of Rebekah, mother of Jacob and Esau. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him off to Padan Aram to take a wife from there, as he blessed him, he commanded him, saying, "You shall not take a wife from among the daughters of Canaan." And that Jacob obeyed his father and mother and went to Padan Aram. Then Esau perceived the daughters of Canaan were evil in the eyes of Isaac, his father. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalah, the daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, sister of Naboth, in addition to his wives, as a wife for himself. That was Genesis chapter 25. Well, most of chapter 25, all the way through the first part of chapter 28. So we have a basic discussion or story about what happens and how Esau and how Jacob interact with one another. Before I get my stuff started on my spiel or details, comments, questions, opinions, thoughts, disagreements. You want to rattle off something that caught your eye, caught your attention? There's a lot of stuff in this section. Mostly, of course, about Jacob and Esau, but there's some bit about Isaac, too. Yes?
I just found it interesting. I've read this a couple of times, but I found it interesting that it was almost 20 years that Isaac was with Rebekah before, and probably praying throughout. I mean, it doesn't really say that, but it was 20 years that he was with her before she became pregnant. And just reading it and, other times, I just assumed that it was shortly after he had taken her and he prayed and she became pregnant. I didn't realize it was such a long time.
Yeah. It was a long time. The barrenness of a woman is only brought up barrenness, not quite the right word. The difficult to conceive concept in the Bible is only brought up 8 different times, 8 different women who have gone through this process. Rebecca, of course, being one of them. There was Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel. Each of them were unable to conceive for a period of time before God finally said, "Okay, now I'm going to bless you for conceiving." And of course, it continues on for Hannah has the same issue, and then we have a list up there. Manoah's wife, the Shunite woman, Elizabeth, and of course, Mary is the only one who it's impossible. But the whole point is they're all mentions of the impossible becoming possible, giving a birth from someone who cannot have children. And it's symbolic of a lot of things. We'll discuss that, probably not today though, when it comes closer to Hanukkah time, because that's where those women and their ordeal is accentuated and talked about, at least in this congregation, because that's what Hanukkah is really about. It's the impossible conception. Along with other things too. Any other comments or questions? But yeah, 20 years is a long time. Comments or questions? Anything else? Anything caught your attention? Well, that's easy. All right. Okay, so there's some details in this section, which we'll get to today. We'll start out, go back to chapter 25 of Genesis. So, of course, we start out with it's been roughly 20 years for Rebekah to have children. So, at this point in time, Abraham's still alive. Abraham doesn't die until he's 125 years old. And that corresponds to Jacob and Esau will be about 15 years old when Abraham dies. So they'll all know each other. They'll have interactions. And they'll discuss and they'll learn their lives together, partially at least. So it's about 15 years before Abraham dies, she's able to have children. Of course, he has Jacob and Esau. In this story, it points out, of course, she has a war going on inside of her. There's a reason why Jacob and Esau and their struggles with one another is likened similar to Isaac and Ishmael and their struggles with one another. Both groups or sets of sons have their symbolic meanings behind them, as far as why God selected them this particular way. We're going to jump around a little bit as far as going through these details. One of the places we're going to head to immediately regarding this topic is, we'll head to Romans chapter 9. This topic of these struggles of these two boys, babies, they're barely considered struggling, is purposeful. So Romans chapter 9, it talks about this issue between these two different types of people, two different groups of people that God is using. And mind you, God is selecting these sons, both Isaac and Ishmael, as well as Jacob and Esau, as lessons for us to learn from these relationships. So Romans 9, which of course this is heavily discussed, is starting out in verse 6. We're not going to read the whole section, just part in verse 6 of Romans chapter 9. It is not that the word of God has taken no effect, for they are not all of Israel who are of Israel, nor are they all children because they are the seed of Abraham. But, the quote, in Isaac your seed shall be called. That is, those who are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God. The children of the promise are counted as the seed. For this is the word of the promise. As the quote, at this time I will come and Sarah shall have a son. And not only with this, but also when Rebekah also had conceived by one man, even our father Isaac, for the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to the election might stand, not from works, but from him who calls. It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. As written, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. What should we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Certainly not. For it is in Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion whom I will have compassion. So that it is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. The scripture also says to Pharaoh, for even the same purpose I have raised you up, that I might show my power in you, that my name might be declared in all the earth. Therefore he has mercy on whom he wills, and whom he wills, he hardens. You'll say to me, then why does he still find fault? For who has resisted his will? Indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me thus? Does not the potter have power over clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and one for dishonor? What if God, wanting to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had prepared beforehand for glory, even to us whom he called, not the Jews only, but also the Gentiles. Now, let's rephrase some of that. we'll leave this up here. So, okay, we have two boys. Well, actually, two sets of boys. So there's Isaac and Ishmael. And their own categories. We'll discuss that shortly in a minute. There's also, of course, Jacob and Esau. I'm going to rotate this slightly so you can see a little better. In these two groups, we have a relationship between those who are promised and those who are of the flesh. In this story, which Romans points out to us, there are two different family lines, essentially. You have those who are promised, which is Isaac and Jacob. Of course, continues on to Joseph. And, that's an E. And it continues on through the line. And Ishmael, Esau, of course, the others, which are not considered part of the flesh, per se. Or, sorry, part of the promise. did Jacob and Esau, while they were in the womb, and God selected Jacob over Esau, was Esau doing anything wrong? No, he's a baby. He's not even technically born yet. Does he know what right and wrong is? Of course not. So why would God choose at that moment in time? He didn't sit there and wait, well, we'll see how the boys grow up. We'll see how they act, how they react, how they live their lives. No, he didn't. He chose ahead of time, predetermined on what was going to happen in this category. Now, we can see and look after as we read the story of Jacob and Esau and realize, oh yeah, God made a good choice. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we understand why he made the choice. And that when God was dealing with these two groups of men, he had chosen Isaac over Ishmael, he chose Jacob over Esau. Now, if you look at these, who was supposed to be chosen? Who was the firstborns? Ishmael and Esau were the firstborn. And who are the secondborns? The guys over here. So, which we find ourselves interesting, because in the Torah it discusses when you have sons, or daughters too if you don't have any sons, the oldest gets a double portion of what all the other ones did. So if you have five kids, you divvy up all your property into six different sections, and then the first child gets two parts and the rest of them get, the remaining balance. So that's what you normally do. You treat the firstborn as superior or greater than everybody else. They're also the inheritor of all the physical property, the land and whatever else you happen to own. But in God's eyes, and when God's going through this process, what does he do? He completely ignores his own rule and says, no, I'm choosing this group, Isaac and Jacob, instead. And what specifically was he choosing for them? Was it property and wealth? No, it was himself. He's making himself be part of this line. It's God's line, and God's choosing this line. This line, yeah, they had money, they had this, they had that, but it wasn't important to him. It wasn't the property God was choosing between these two family lines. It was himself. Which line is God going to attach himself to? He chose Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and continue on the storyline. That's the line he chose, that he was going to belong to. What was his criteria? He just chose. He just chose. He promised Isaac because he chose Isaac. He wanted Isaac. But Isaac wasn't born yet. But he told Abraham at the time, hey, it's through you and through your wife, Sarah, that's the one I'm going to choose. Does God know what kind of person Isaac's going to be? Maybe, maybe not. But Isaac wasn't even conceived yet. Well, in this case, when Jacob and Esau show up, what does God do? He tells Rebecca, I'm choosing this one. Have those boys done anything yet to warrant being chosen or not chosen? No. God's choosing them. So, well, this Apostle Paul brings out, why? Is that right? Is that fair? Is that just? Of course it is, because it's God. Why I went through Romans 9, as it points out, verse 21, does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and one for dishonor? God created Esau, God created Ishmael, God created Isaac, and created Jacob. And what was their purpose? These men over here, Ishmael and Esau, was created not for him. God did not create Ishmael and Esau for himself. He created those are the sons of the flesh. Who were those to show us the difference between this group who he didn't choose and this group who he did. The purpose of God selecting these men, before they did anything to warrant being selected, was to point out that God created these other men for their purpose, and he created the Isaac and Jacob men for their purpose. And God is choosing them. We can say, well, he was right, he was wrong, this is fair, that's not fair. That's empty words. We aren't the creator. I didn't make it. He did. He made Pharaoh. And what was Pharaoh's purpose? What was the purpose God made Pharaoh, as it points out here? So that I have raised you up that I might show my power in you and my name might be declared in all the earth. So what was Pharaoh's objective? What was his reason for living? So that God would destroy him. That was his reason for existence. So God made Pharaoh to be destroyed. We think, oh, why would God do that? God's love and his kindness, loving. Yes, he is. But that doesn't mean he doesn't make things for a purpose. We read the book of Revelation, for example. There's lots of destroying things in there, isn't there? Oh, this gets destroyed, this gets wiped out, this gets destroyed, this, burn that, crash that, whatever happens to be. Lots of stuff like that. So, well, God planned it. You know, our books, he wrote them. He preset what was going to happen. So he had designed there was going to be groups of people who are corrupt and groups of people who aren't. And he is the builder of all. Is there an ant that lives that God doesn't know about? Of course not. So is there a person, actions that God doesn't know about? Of course not. He knows about everything. So everything has a function and purpose. And what's the purpose? To teach us. Because we're, no offense, dumb. Yes, Anne.
I think because of these things that are difficult to understand, you know, the Christians, I mean, some Christians have dichotomized God and said, well, that's the God of the Old Testament.
The mean one.
And that's the God of the New Testament is right. God is love.
Right.
And so they want to make him have a split personality or something.
Judaism does the same thing. It doesn't make much difference with Christianity, but it is a separation of those. So that was who is mean, and that's who is kind. And they try to divide them out. The problem is that God created everything, which means he created the idea of good and bad, and how he uses them, and how we use them, of course, for different reasons. David, your hand was up. Go ahead.
Yeah, Lisa and I were looking at something this morning, and when Paul uses the term that Jacob I love, but Esau
I hated. Right.
And the article was saying that, you know, that that's actually a Jewish, how do you say, idiom?
Yeah.
Where it actually is not in the context that we look at love and hate.
It's not a hate, not like a hate as we think of an intense hatred.
But they were saying that even kings would do that when it came to covenants or promises, that the one that they made a covenant with was the one that they love, and the one that they would not make a covenant with, where they would use the term that's the same word that we use for hated.
Right.
But it wasn't really in the context of...
The unselected is the other way of wording it. The unchosen one.
Yes.
Well, it was not chosen for a variety of reasons. We term the term hate in English as, and I have an emotional great dislike toward you, wishing harm upon you. That's not a fair Hebrew definition of the word. The Hebrew additional word is, I have selected this one and not that one. I don't want that one. For whatever reason. It's dirty, it's clean, it's this, too tall, too short. Make a difference. It's just, I don't want it. I want this one instead. That's the term which referred to love versus hate, as opposed to the intense emotion of, I want harm to be upon you. That's not the case. That's not how either Greek nor Hebrew interprets that word. Yes?
Just kind of contrasting, I guess, a little bit to God's sovereignty, we have our will. So the Isaac-Jacob union came out of obedience.
They did.
Eventually. And then, too, I just thought it was interesting how they both had the 12 sons.
Yes.
And maybe you'll get into that later, how that spreads out.
Yeah, the 12 sons of Esau wasn't to go through today. It might be in Jeff's section, I'm not sure. But yes, they do continue on to their alliance, and of course, they get blessed. Ishmael, though God didn't choose him to be part of his line, was still heavily blessed. He had many, many sons. They all became kings of their own regions. Lots of descendants, lots of property, lots of everything. Esau, similarly. Many sons, lots of property, lots of wealth. They were still physically and their children still blessed as generations went on. The distinction being they weren't blessed with God, meaning that God attached himself to them, but rather God attached himself to this line, which is the blessing we're all after. It's called life. We want eternal life, and he's the only one who can give it. So that was the section that he was saying, hey, guys, I'm going to go through my path through this one, Isaac, Jacob, and continue on through Joseph and all the others through. But I'm not choosing another path over here. That's not to say any member over on the Ishmael-Esau side cannot walk across the fence and say, hey, I want to join you. Well, we have examples of Moab, we have examples of Ammon, we have examples of others too that came from this side and married into this side. I wish to be on this line instead, choosing to follow God. That's perfectly acceptable. It's where your free will comes in. that, hey, I am choosing, this is my path, I don't want this path, I'm choosing that one over there. It's a better path. That one leads to actual life, rather than physical wealth. Yes, Kat?
Did Ishmael live in Israel?
Well, parts, for a short period of time, yes, but not for most of it. Most Ishmaels, I'll draw a brief map. I'm brief because it's not very accurate, but it's somewhat close. I'll erase part of this real quick. Ishmael's, most of his territory was headed toward the east. So if this is a Mediterranean map, so it's a blown up one. So I have Sinai Peninsula there, here's Egypt down here, Israel's up here, there's the two forks of the river, the Red Sea. I'm abbreviating. That doesn't occur quite that sharp. Anyway, so Israel's proper territory was basically in this area along here. And Hebron, that territory where Abraham hung out, was about that general area of Israel. When Ishmael was born, he moved east along with most of Abraham's following descendants. He had many children after Isaac was born. He had children through Keturah, his concubine or second wife, how you call it. They all moved this way and south. So they all moved east and south. Most of them were in that territory. And Abraham said specifically he sent them that way. With lots of property, lots of money, lots of supplies. This is your territory. This is where you will live. They spread and filled in this territory. For a brief period of time, they were in Israel as they were young. And they were growing. But once they came of age, he sent them off. Esau, similarly, once when Jacob left and goes off to Laban's house, all of Isaac's physical property, where does it go? It's the one son who's there, Esau. So Esau physically receives all of Isaac's wealth. We say, well, wow, that's not a blessing to Jacob. Well, actually it is, because Esau was still being blessed. All of Isaac's property, all of his possessions, when Jacob took off, and Isaac dies, Rebekah dies, it all goes to Esau. So he becomes very, very wealthy. But the deal is, Esau, go with your descendants, your cousins, to the east. Don't stay here. And so, that's what he did. So it makes sense. They grew up in the Israel proper territory, but then they were all cast to go east. Anne, go ahead.
The question that I have is it possible, probably possible, that that Jacob and Esau knew of this prophecy long before, you know, it came to that point where the prophecy of the younger son?
Yeah, the younger son. I don't know. Could be. It's possible.
Maybe
I'm
Rebecca.
Assuming the details between what God spoke to Rebecca, I'm assuming Rebecca shared them with her husband. I'm assuming that. I mean, I don't know. She may have kept it herself for 40 years. But I'm assuming that she shared them with her husband, so her husband was aware of what God had told to her. But she may not have. And if she did share it with him, the sons may or may not have been told. I don't know. It doesn't tell us what they knew or didn't know. But I can tell you this. Someone wrote it down in our Bibles. And whoever wrote it down, presumably Moses wrote it down, somehow the information got to Moses. So if it got to Moses, and Jacob already left, went to Padan Aram, he's hanging out, he'll be hanging out there for 20 years, while his mother and father live and pass on. The information has to get to Jacob, so it'll be transferred on to the rest of the kids, to finally reach to Moses. So somehow, the information got from Isaac, from Rebekah, to Jacob, in order to get the information to Moses, so we can write it down, we can read about it today. So, somewhere along the lines, Jacob and Esau knew about it, but I don't know when they knew, whether it was before or after the blessing. Does that make sense?
Okay. Now, another question. I heard that that Jacob and Esau were close to 78 years old when the blessing was passed on.
It would not be that old, because Esau and Jacob were about 40 when Jacob takes off. So the blessing that occurred had to be before, well, at least 40 or earlier, as far as how old they were when this event occurred. I say about 40. They could have been 42, 43, could have been 38. Somewhere in that ballpark of that range of age. Does that make sense?
Isaac lived 40 more years after that event?
I believe so. I wonder how old he was at this time. It depends on the exact ages. I did not map out their lives. Actually, my book might have a map of their lives. Come think of it.
He lost his eyesight at...
He lost his eyesight when the boys were still relatively young.
Right.
There is an argument in Judaism, which I believe is probably erroneous, but just my personal opinion, that the time which Esau came in and asking for food from Jacob was the moment which Abraham died. Was that was the day or the year he died? I think that's a bit of a stretch, because both boys would be about 15 when Abraham dies, and that's not likely. Let's see. Jacob, Esau. Let's see here. So Abraham dies at 175 years old. Isaac gives birth. Sorry, Rebekah gives birth when Isaac is 60. So Abraham has 15 more years left. So 175. Abraham's 175. Abraham's 175 years old. Genesis. Let's see. Chapter. The previous chapter, 24, I think, or 23, specifies how old Abraham is when he passes. Oh, Isaac. Yeah. Isaac, 180, thereabouts. Okay. All right. So, yeah, Abraham, 175. So, their ages for Abraham, 175. Okay. So that's their ages, roughly, what's going on. As far as what ages they were when each of the events took place, there's speculation and guessing on certain events. Because it doesn't tell you how old it was when the blessing happened. It doesn't tell you how old it was when the birthright sale actually happened. Either way, there's arguments as far as when it occurred. It still happened when the men... I say it probably wasn't when Abraham died, the birthright sale. The reason is this, because it says Esau grew up to be a man of hunting. A 15-year-old is not considered a man. So the likelihood of that story of coming in from the field as a man at 15, when Abraham dies, would not make a lot of sense. So most likely it was the birthright sale occurred after Abraham's death. However many years later, I don't know. Right. It could have been relatively old by the time they did most, well, our definition of old, by the time each of these events occur. Other questions so far regarding Esau and Jacob and their first encounter? Okay. So God's selection, when he selected these two son groups, as far as Isaac and Jacob versus Ishmael and Esau, it required him to reject what we classify as the firstborn, the physical firstborn son, which is consistent with what Romans instructs us to be or to understand, is that it explains that Isaac and Ishmael, actually, I think it's Hebrews discusses it, one's supposed to be, or Galatians, sorry, it was Galatians discuss it. One's supposed to be the son of promise, and one's was the son of the flesh. And then two of them cannot function together. They're not to be interacting, to be at one with other, and raise themselves up. We discussed this previously when Isaac was first being promised about, Sarah and Abraham, and that Sarah instructing Abraham to kick out Ishmael and his mom. We had pointed out that in Galatians that Ishmael and Isaac had a problem if they were raised together. The raising was that Ishmael, of course, was being the oldest son. He would have, obviously, heavy influence over Isaac's raising, his viewpoint and his worldview of life. As a result, Ishmael would gain far more over Isaac if they're raised together. And Apostle Paul points out that this issue between these two is symbolic between those who are believers in Messiah, in this category of Isaac, versus those who are non-believers, over here where Ishmael is. This non-believing group, not that they aren't holy, not that they aren't righteous, they're just not believers in Messiah, would have undue or over influence over those who were believing category. Hence, God separated out Jews, and we classify as Christians. They are different groups. If they were not separated out, the Christian group, as points out in Galatians, would fall. It would fail. It would fall apart. Because they were made to stick together as a united body. Those who were older, who had more wisdom, had more knowledge, been around a long time, would then influence and change the viewpoint of the Gentiles coming in. or the Jews who have been kicked out. They would influence and alter that to match their own because they are the older sons. They are the older, they have more knowledge, more wisdom, more everything. So their knowledge and wisdom would then alter the Christian groups who were just learning out what Messiah is. So God intentionally divided them up to keep them separate, as he separated Isaac from Ishmael and Jacob and Esau. These two lions had to be separate. If they stayed together, one, the chosen side, would fail. It would fall apart. It couldn't stand on its own. It's not strong enough. This side over here, where Ishmael, Esau, or it was classified as Judaism versus Christianity, the Judaism would dominate, the Christianity would fall. That's what it was would have done. But God divided them up and separated them on purpose. It wasn't by accident. As it says, he's the one who chooses one vessel for glory and one vessel for dishonor. He's the one who chooses one category to this and one category to that, to divide them up. That was his intention. In my personal family's history, we have a saying, God multiplies by dividing. He's very good at it. The big group divides them all up because then those little people all group and have their own little groups. They multiply and they spread and grow. Same principle. Dividing these groups up allowed one group, the one he was going to bless with his own name, to grow and be prosperous. Keeping it together, it was going to fall apart. Does it make sense? Any questions or comments so far about that? That's recorded in Galatians chapter 4, in case you want to read it again yourself. We read it 2 weeks ago. Yeah, 2 weeks ago, rather. Let's see here. Let's move forward. Genesis, back to 25 Genesis. We are done with the lives and deaths of everybody. So in Genesis 25, this is just a nuance, a minor detail. So Esau, of course, gets named by everybody because he comes out red and hairy and, well, at least red and hairy. The word red and hairy, it means, the word Esau means completely developed. He's fully, he's an adult. Come birth and he's an adult. red and hairy man. Everybody names him because of his obvious appearance. In the case for Jacob, it appears that Isaac is the one who names Jacob. I point that out to you because in Judaism it is not necessarily required that the dad gets to name the sons. It's a tradition in our culture that parents are work together, but the dad gets to take some part. Typically, we call it the last name. He gets the last name of whatever this child happens to be. That's our cultural tradition. Judaism, not necessarily. You may or may not be named by your dad. You might be named by your mom. As you notice, Jacob's sons, he has 12 sons, right? How many did he name? How many did his wives name? He names one, his wives name all the rest of them. They're all the sons of Jacob, but he doesn't get to choose what name they're called. His wives do. So the relationship between who gets to name a child is not always well defined. But in this case, of course, Jacob's name is named by Isaac, his dad.
Wives, happy
father. Yeah, yeah, that's a good statement. So of course, as the boys grow up, there's a famine shows up in the land. Oh, sorry. First, before we go there, verse 34. The birthright, the spurning or despising his birthright. In the tail end of 25, it discusses the relationship between Isaac and, sorry, Jacob and Esau going back and forth. And Esau points out that he believes he's about to die. Is he really going to die? No. He's in his home camp. He's not going to die. There's a bunch of people around, plenty of things. But he believes that is better off to be fed by this food than this, his birthright. What is his birthright? The inheritance. And what specifically inheritance? There's two different groups that we call inheritance. Yes, Tammy.
Basically, the faith of Abraham.
Right.
And so, like, the Orthodox Study Bible makes a comment. It says, Esau was the older son, so the right of the firstborn was his. This rite taught the firstborn to embrace Abraham's faith, but he despised this faith because of his fear of death. He despised the very faith that could have saved him from death.
Yep. Very well said. The birthright specifically has two categories. It's a birthright of money, which is property and things of that nature. But the birthright that Esau was despising wasn't money. He was despising what was it? He already knew he was going to get all the stuff. That's his dad's the deal. It's not between him and his brother. All the stuff wasn't matter to him. It's Abraham's right. What was Abraham's right? What was the birthright? What did Abraham pass on to his children? God. God and life. The promise that God gave. That was a birthright that Esau is saying, what good is this to me? I'll have all the money. I don't care for this birthright. It's not valuable to me. Of course, Hebrews points out that that Esau was considered a profane or godless man. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, we're not going to read the whole thing, but this is starting in verse 12 of Hebrews 12. Strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. Make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all men and holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Look diligently, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness spring up and cause trouble. And by this may many become defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane, which means godless, person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. Do you catch that? So, what's he saying? Esau's rejection of this birthright produced something else to him as well. It's the blessing that also was part of that birthright, though Esau may not have agreed to it. That's what it was. It's the blessing. By this sale, he lost the blessing too. And it points out in this that even though he sought it diligently with tears, which it points out in that story when he's saying, telling his father, hey, is there a blessing for me too? What's Esau doing? He says he's weeping, he's crying, he's yelling out. He's truly repentant in his heart, saying, I want this too. But it points out here, because he spurned this birthright, in verse 11, verse 17, it says, he wanted to inherit the blessing, but he was rejected for he found no place for repentance. So this rejection of his birthright wiped out his ability to repent. You catch that? That's a big deal. The rejection of God, knowing what it was, wiped out his ability to come back to God and say, hey, I want this too. It's too late. Rejecting God's a big deal. Reject the birthright was a big deal. He wanted food instead. This birthright resulted in his rejection of God. As a result from that, the subsequent event is he lost his blessing too. We said, but Rebecca did that. It wasn't Esau. No, it was pre-planned. God set this up. Mind you, he's the author of our books. So God had this all designed to begin with. Esau's rejection initially, he knew what he was getting rid of. He knew what he didn't want. And then when the time came where the rewards were dished out and the blessings, said, oh, but wait, no, me too, me too, me too. God's saying, no, you rejected me. And you've rejected me all this time. I'm not going to say, oh, well, I'll relent, here's your gift anyway. No, that would be called bad parenting. You're a bad parent. Say, okay, parent, child, do this, do this. I'll do nothing, nothing. At the end of it, you did nothing. Oh, well, here's your ice cream anyway. No, that's called bad parenting. You parent your child correctly. Hey, you earned nothing. You spurned the entire process, and now you want the blessing of everlasting life anyway? Doesn't work that way. You have to actually want it and try to do something or try to travel forward, as everybody else whom, with Isaac's line that God selected, they all did. Now, did any of them make mistakes? Of course they did. Nothing about that. We're referring to this category of what God's saying. When you reject the birthright, reject him, the repentance is far harder to get to when the rewards get dished out. Now, is that saying Esau couldn't repent earlier before the blessing? Of course he could. Would he get his blessing back? Probably. But at the very end, it's too late. Yes.
Well, it kind of goes along with somewhere else in Scripture where it says that God's gifts are irrevocable. He doesn't, you know, once it's given, it's given. You know, the gift that, you know, in physical laws should have gone to Esau was already given to Jacob. So God would have had to take it back from Jacob even to give it to Esau, aside from the fact that this is all predestined.
Right. Right. Once Jacob received the birthright, and that was the deal, and God had already selected him before he was born, that was going to happen. It was going to go to Jacob. All the blessings would go to Jacob. Esau, just as he grows through his life, we can see, yeah, that makes sense, because he spurned it. He didn't want it. He wanted his own thing. He did his own life and lived his whole life all the way to the very end. And at the very end, as God points out in the parables, those pounding on the doors, hey, let me in too. He said, I never knew you. You waited to the very end. I mean, when God's coming down and saying, okay, here's out my rewards, here's my corrections, here's this and that and other, and everybody says, well, I don't care, didn't care who you were, but now we're all sitting here. Me too. But wait a minute. I never knew you. You did nothing. You've done nothing. You rejected me your entire existence, and now you're changing your mind? It's kind of late now. Now, could I have changed my mind earlier, before the blessing? Of course! God is infinitely forgiving. But there is a point where forgiveness finally says, yeah, the rope's gone. There's no more string left. You're hanging by the thread. The threads aren't there anymore. It's too late to say, I'm sorry. Yes?
Well, it kind of, of course, like you said, it doesn't tell us whether or not the boys knew about this before it happened. But supposing they did, you know, that's a possible picture of Esau even taking this for granted, you know, because if he did know about it, he probably just figured his dad was going to give it to him anyway, you know, thus possibly the reason why he didn't think he needed to do anything.
That's probably true. There's a reason why it points out that Isaac loved Esau, but not his mom. His mom loved Jacob instead. Well, he said, well, hey, as long as I'm good with dad, the one who has all the power, mom, who cares what you think? Well, it turned out it didn't matter what mom thought, too. Yes, Anne.
You know, we're always hearing God is the God of second chances.
He is.
And, you know, looking at Jonah and
many, many
Saint
second chances.
Peter,
yep.
And, yep. You know, but the difference, I think, is, as you say, the rejection all the other years, all the way.
Your whole life.
And then at the last minute, or he's crying. But even Cain was crying, I can't take this burden. And the Lord said, well, he put a mark on him. So this is sort of a second chance for Cain.
In a manner of speaking, but Cain's end wasn't there yet. The end wasn't until they all entered the ark and all the lions were saying, okay, they can't pound the door of the ark, say, hey, let me in too. It's already sealed up and it's raining. Guess what? You're not getting in. You can pound all you want. You're not getting in. You spurned all the way up to that point. The Cain's end wasn't time yet. The dishing out, so to speak, or the spreading out of the blessing of the flood, or how you call it, blessing or curse, depending on your perspective of who you were, it's too late at that point to change your mind and say, hey, I'm sorry, me too, me too, me too. You waited too long. There was plenty of time to choose, and you waited beyond your time limit. God is patient, but he has time limits. Yes, Jeff.
Well, one of those instructions about the, even though he sought repentance with many tears, you know, it kind of also connects with the Passover talks about that godly sorrow leads to repentance. Because, you know, there's plenty of people who weep about the punishment they get.
Yeah.
But is it actually, are they wanting to actually turn around and go another direction? Or are they just sorry that, oh, they didn't get it?
Yeah.
The sorry for the consequences.
Yes. Okay, any questions so far? I'm going to move forward. We are beyond the birthright section. All right? Okay. Let's move. We are jumping to 26. I've talked about this in years past. I'll bring this up again. There's a famine in the land. Of course, Isaac and his family are all, there's a different one from the one that happened in Abraham's time. So Isaac's ready to leave. Now, in Abraham's time, the famine, Abraham took off, went to Egypt at that time. Well, in Isaac's case, God's telling him specifically, You won't. You're staying in this land. You don't leave it. And of course, in verse 3, this is when the Lord's talking to him. Sorry, verse 2, Lord says, don't go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land, which I shall tell you. Sojourn this land. I'll be with you, bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands. I'll perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. I'll make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands, and all your seed, the nations of the earth, shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my Torah, my laws. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar. I bring this up because God's treating Isaac differently than he treated Abraham and Jacob. And there's a reason why. In Abraham and Jacob's case, both men were perfectly allowed to leave. In Abraham's case, I'm gonna brief, and Jacob, both of them, they went to Egypt. In Jacob's case, he also, of course, goes to Aram to find a wife. In Isaac's case, he is confined to what we call today Israel proper. Why? Why does God okay for Abraham to leave, and he even okays Jacob to leave, but not to Isaac? Because something happened in Isaac's life that didn't happen to Abraham and to Jacob. What's the one thing, the biggest thing that happened in Isaac's life when he was a boy? He almost got sacrificed. Isaac is holy. He's different than Jacob and Abraham. He is holy. So Isaac, holy. Why is he holy? Because he was set aside for a sacrifice to God, just like Messiah was set aside as a sacrifice to God. Messiah was holy. After Messiah got sacrificed, physically, Isaac obviously never went through it, but close to it. When Messiah got sacrificed, what do you tell everybody? Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Why? He's holy. Don't touch him. Well, in Isaac's case, he's been offered to God, not physically, but spiritually offered to God. He is now a holy burnt offering. His holy belongs to God. And in God's holy offering, what does he say? Don't contaminate my holy things with unholy stuff. So, Egypt, which we learn from Moses when he goes up, it's symbolic of sin, it's symbolic of the world, symbolic of leavening, puffing one up, all those stuffs. And Aram, which we also learn, is symbolic, which happens later on after Moses, symbolic of treachery, cruelness, anger, and deceit. So all these groups, are either those holy? No. What's God said? Say to Isaac, this land will be yours. This is the land I've chosen for you. You stay here. Isaac has to remain holy, meaning separate from the others, because Isaac is a holy offering, versus Abraham and Jacob aren't. Neither one of them got on an altar and had a knife almost slashed through them, but Isaac did. So that's the distinction. Hence God saying, Isaac, don't leave the land. You stay here. And of course he does. Even Abraham points out when he was looking for a son or a wife for Isaac, told a servant, don't take my son back there. Abraham knew Isaac doesn't leave. He stays here. So Abraham recognized something unique about Isaac. He stays in this land. And God also points at Isaac, you stay in this land. Jacob, yeah, go, come, whatever. Abraham, go, come, whatever. Isaac, you stay. Why? Isaac is holy. He must remain separate. Because Messiah is holy. He is separate. He is unique. Therefore, Messiah, Isaac is unique. He's separate. He's holy. It's symbol. It's strictly a symbol. It's not that Isaac is physically holy. It's symbolic. It's a spiritual definition of what the word means. Okay, let's continue forward. So Isaac stays in the area. He stays, of course, in the territory of Israel proper, which goes over to where we call the Philistine territory. Draw a brief little map here, roughly. Not the exact. It's not perfect, but it's okay. Israel, something like that. In this territory here, we call the Gaza Strip today. It was much bigger then. He's in the Gerar territory, because Hebron is roughly about here, which is where he was hanging out beforehand. Actually, a little further that way. Jerusalem is a non-important city, but it's up there for now. It gets important later. So he hangs out over in this generalized territory in the southern tip, southern area of it. What does he do? He gets there, because this is the same Abimelech and the same Pichol that Abraham dealt with years earlier. These are the same guys, so nothing's changed much. He goes there, of course, he gets blessed. He's concerned, of course, by their desire for his wife, which we'll discuss that later, as far as his desires. Oh, yes.
I just had a question on 26.5.
26.5, yes.
And I've looked at those words, you know, that he uses there, my commandments, my statutes, my laws. They're the same that is used in Deuteronomy 11.1, which we know what those are. So could this be a clue to the fact that at Mount Sinai they were written, but they've always had laws, commandments, and statutes, or is that reading too much into it, or...
I would not say it's reading too much into it. What I would say is that the laws spelled out with Torah, and when Moses gave them all listed out, gave a lot of details and what you should and shouldn't do that Abraham would have intuitively already known. He didn't have to have them written out. At the same time, Abraham and his grandson, Jacob, with the marrying of sisters and such, those are against the rules in the Torah, but yet they followed them. As far as they did them. And Abraham marrying his sister, because that's what he says, Sarah is a sister of his dad and not his mom, is prohibited in the Torah. You can't do that. But Abraham, of course, perfectly acceptable. And God blessed that marriage and those offspring. So what I would say is that the vast majority of the laws written in the Torah were known. But some either weren't laws, or weren't important yet, didn't matter, or we're not known. Make sense?
Yeah, so what I'm saying then is, so then, because a lot of the Mosaic laws were a breakdown of the definitions, giving it more understanding to what they might have already known, just not all the implications of moving a cornerstone, marrying right. your sister, and these things.
Right. And how to sacrifice to get out of problems, as far as what the offering was supposed to be for this sin versus that sin. None of that would necessarily have been explained. On the other hand, many of the laws would have been known by Abraham. Because obviously they knew what clean and unclean was. Well, that's not defined to the Torah. But everybody knew it all the way from Adam and Eve. So somebody had to tell it to begin with, say, this is clean, this is unclean. Whether it was Adam who said, this is clean and unclean versus God, I don't know. But what somebody did and passed the knowledge on. They also pass knowledge about crops and other things, that what is the tenth to God. All these details had been spelled out, and they were spelled out, and somebody obeyed them for many, many generations. Moses writes them all down for those of us who were dense and didn't get it. They need it all spelled out. I'm included. And we had to have it spelled, okay, what's the requirement here versus there? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would have known most of the laws in their conceptual form. Not necessarily in the details of, well, this requires this punishment, this person's poor, they can only afford this, it's this much. That may not have been known. But these were all dealing with people who had the means to take care of these things, so it wouldn't have been a big deal for the costs. Every detail.
Number four, for example, in Abraham's day.
The Shabbat?
Yes.
He may have known that. And I'm going to say that because Egypt knew that. So if Egypt knew that, he probably knew it too. So the fourth commandment was probably known. And love the Lord your God, yes, that was known. Honor your father and mother, that's known. Don't murder, that's known. Don't steal, that's known. All those, the basic Ten Commandments, they're all known. Those are obvious things. So those would have been well ingrained in the society all the way from Adam onward. Probably, yeah, most likely Adam and onward. They've been all fully known. Why Cain was so upset the fact he got in trouble for killing somebody. And he was mad enough to kill a man. Again, also Lamech later on, which also kills men. And no, this is serious punishment. This is a serious problem. We should die for what we've done. Well, how would they know they should die for what they've done? Unless it was spelled out to them somewhere along. You're not supposed to murder people. So clearly, many things were known. And also with Cain and Abel, there were appointed times which they were supposed to meet with God. Well, appointed time called them holy days. So there were appointments that God made with them, and they all knew about them. So Abraham probably knew some of those as well. If not necessarily all, but some. Some he would not have known. For example, Passover hasn't occurred yet. So Abraham knowing Passover is pretty limited, probably no. But some of the other feast days and holy days that God spells out in Torah, he may have known about a few of them, if not most. Yes?
Is Judah and Tamar. That's they knew about Levirate marriage.
They knew, yep. They knew Levirate marriage.
Spelled out until
exactly.
After Mount Sinai.
Levirate marriage. It's the Levite marriage. Levirate marriage. It's the, all right, you have a son, they have many sons, and the oldest one gets married. He dies, but they have kids. Well, the wife, it's the next brother in line. Please go enter, have a baby, and then you go live off your own life. You don't have to stay married if you don't want to. But the point is that the property rights continue on. If Judah and Tamar knew about that, which clearly they did, then that law was known about, or it was acceptable behavior at that time. So most likely, Abraham knew about it too, and probably had known for many years. So lots of laws are written and known, but not to every detail that's spelled out in the Torah. Make sense?
Because when I'm part of the study line, it doesn't address 11:1.
Oh, it doesn't? See, I do. Avoid that one. Certain things you don't talk about. There's a reason.
It's just not in there.
Yeah, it's just not there. We'll bypass it. Okay. It's, where was I? Let's see. Moving on to... Oh, his sister. So same Abimelech, same Pichol that he's dealing with. Obviously, he goes and hangs in the area territory. God blesses him, yada, yada, yada. We know the story. Any obvious questions regarding Rebecca and being his sister and not being his sister, all that kind of stuff? Clearly, Isaac wasn't telling the truth. That's obvious because he wasn't his sister. And, of course, Abimelech gets upset. What I want to point out to you, look at Abimelech's reaction. Verse 11 of chapter 26. So, Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely put to death. I point that reaction out. It's not because he's not saying, Isaac, Rebecca, this is absurd. Live your life. No, he's actually pointing out, oh, you might be right. So everybody, anybody touches him or his wife, I'll kill you. The point is, he knows his territory. He knows people he's ruling over. What's their instinctive reaction? Isaac was probably right. They probably would have killed him for her. Just like Abraham was probably right. They probably would have killed Abraham for her too. So Abimelech is not addressing the fact that his people would never have done such a crime. He's pointing out that, okay, I'll put a punishment on anybody who actually does. Only on you two, though. He didn't say everybody else. It's just on you and your wife. If anybody harms you or takes her, I'll kill them. Everybody else, it's free for all. But on you two, no. Yes, Karen.
I was kind of thinking about that before when we read through the Abraham accounts, too. Is that, yeah, we could look at it as Abraham was so fearful that he lied. But at the same time, what better way for God's power to be shown 100% than for him to be the one that acted? You know, for him to tell Pharaoh, I think it was.
Yeah, it was Pharaoh, and then it was all Abimelech. He talked to both men.
You know, but for God to be the one to say,
you don't do this. Yeah.
She's somebody else's.
Yep.
You know, then the men didn't have any burden of, you know, anything.
Yep. Exactly. So there's obviously reasons why Abraham and Isaac both feared the people they were heading toward, because they probably had a reputation. Note what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, with the whole wiping out and how they were doing bad things to people who were coming up. That wasn't in a bubble, to where Sodom and Gomorrah are the only people who have ever done such a thing, and it's never been heard of before outside the city walls. If the cries went up to God, and Abraham even pointed out, I'm not going near that town, their existence and how they treated people was probably well known. If it was well known, the Philistines around the corner probably knew it too. If they knew it, they may have been acting somewhat similarly. Not to say the same, but possibly similarly. Such that going in that territory was dangerous for Abraham or for Isaac or for anybody else. So it's possible the reputation was known. And therefore, this generated Isaac and Abraham's great concern. Any questions regarding that topic so far? Obviously, Abimelech sees the fact they're not brother and sister and addresses that issue. Oh, okay, let's move on to the next section. If you recall, way back when Abraham was here, give me the marker, Abimelech made an agreement with Abraham That was when Abraham was still alive. The first agreement, back when, shortly after Sodom and Gomorrah was wiped out, Abraham went to Gerar, and Abimelech made an agreement with him, with Abraham and their son, their sons. Is that the descendants? And descendants would not do evil to one another. That means Abimelech, I'm going to abbreviate, and Abraham. For many years, generations come down, all the way down, they would not mistreat each other. That was the agreement that happened with Abraham, and that's how they got the first name of Beersheba, or about that time, that they would make this agreement. Well, in this account, what happened after Abraham died? What did all the Philistines, the herdsmen, do that were Abimelech's men? What'd they do? They filled in the wells. Is that doing evil? Yes, a little bit evil. Yes, is that breaking the agreement? Yes, that's breaking the agreement. And so when Isaac shows up, and Isaac, of course, digs these wells, and before he digs the wells, he's very well prosperous while he's there. And the deal, the agreement was your descendants too. So Abimelech's supposed to treat Isaac as if he was Abraham himself, as allowing him to free the land, use as you need, grow. Of course, Isaac does, and as a result, Abimelech says, get out. Go away. Again, is that treating agreement, to matching the agreement? No, that's violating the agreement. You're not treating fairly. You didn't tell anybody else to leave, just Isaac and his men. So, again, Abimelech is the one who's violating the agreement he made with Abraham multiple times. And, of course, his men are too. Then, of course, as these wells get redug, new ones, which I'll point out, this is an important concept, important detail. Isaac redigs all of his father's wells. But he also digs new ones. Alright? How many new wells did he total dig? He winds up digging totally of 4. Alright? But he breaks them up in a set of 3 and then 1. The first two to focus on. There are 3 wells initially. Wells are important in biblical terminology. They are symbolic of something. It is symbolic of the grave. It is also symbolic of life. I say that because they are an opposite. So it's the concept of going down to a deep hole, you're dead, and then coming back out of it, you're not dead. The idea of life is getting out of the well. The number 3 in the idea of a deep hole in the ground is symbolic of one individual. And who is the individual it's symbolic of? Messiah. It's the only one it can be, because the whole 3 days the grave, 3 days the dead, and come back to life again, right? So Isaac digs 3 wells. The first 2 wells, he digs and they quarrel and he has to leave and go find a new well. And then finally, after the 3rd well is dug, what does Isaac say? I have peace. Now I can be fruitful and multiply. Now there's space for me. Now I'm sufficiently left alone so I can grow, be prosperous. Which that is symbolic of the whole idea of Messiah. After the 3 days in the grave, when he comes back after the 3rd day, what happens? We now have life. We have life given to people freely from the kingdom of God, from God himself. So this whole idea of Isaac and how he's going through this battle is that he battles the 3 wells. And by the 3rd well, when the 3rd well comes, he finally has strength. He finally has life and be fruitful and multiply. He can finally obey what God commands. You will take over the whole territory. That is symbolic of Messiah himself. Anytime you see number 3 and associate with life or death, it's always symbolic of Messiah. Just find it. Just look at it and read it through. It'll tell you what Messiah is going to be doing. So that's the whole concept. You have 3 wells. You finally have freedom or fruitfulness or prosperity. So make sense? That's an important thing. What I want to bring out to you again is the 4th well. Before the 4th well is dug, or actually before Isaac finds out about it, Abimelech and his soldiers, soldier, Pichol, come and meet with him. Let's see, we're at verse... thank you. Verse 36. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzah, one of his friends, and Pichol, the commander of his army. Mind you, if he comes as the commander of his army, he's not coming for peace. You don't come with your commander of your army, that's your military battle strategist, to inspect out your enemies. Say, oh, I'm coming in peace. That's called lying. You're coming to find out how strong your enemy is, and you want your commander there to scope everybody out. Okay, so we know who, what his job is. I say, why have you come to me? Since you hate me, you sent me away from you. We have certainly seen the Lord is with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, between you and us. Make us covenant with you. You will do us no harm, since we have not touched you. Note, did he touch Rebekah and Isaac? No, that was a law. You can't touch Rebekah and Isaac or we'll kill you. And we've done nothing to you but good and have sent you away in peace. Did that happen? Not exactly, no. I wouldn't say did good and sent him in peace. They kicked him out and said, go away. And you're now, of course, blessed of the Lord. So what's their reason for coming? After the third well, before Isaac knows about the fourth one, Abimelech, I'm going to abbreviate, and Pichol, I remember his name, and his other friend, I forgot the other friend's name, the other guy's name. They all come to see Isaac. Now, note, in this section, from the three well onward, Isaac is acting like Messiah. So pretend, replace the word Isaac with Messiah. Alright, you'll get the whole picture of what's going on here. So, Messiah spends 3 days in the well, digging wells out, before he finally is fruitful and multiply, can now spread out and grow and be abundant. So now Abimelech, king of Gerar and the Philistines with his commander, are coming to Messiah and saying, hey, you're blessed by God. You're wonderful. We've treated you really, really well, right? What's their goal? What would anybody's goal be, going to Messiah saying and buttering him up? I want what you have. I want to be like you, and please be nice. Don't be mad at me. That's the goal. Because Isaac is acting as Messiah, and Isaac points out, what have you to do with me? You threw me out. You ran me away. You rejected me. You say, oh, no. We'll be good now. We'll be kind. We'll be wonderful. Believe us. We'll treat you well now. There's a reason why the story is doing that. When Messiah comes to rule the earth, are the nations going to be, say, thrilled? Woohoo! Yeah, he's here. No. What are they going to be doing? They're going to be upset. They're going to be mad. But when he's ruler, what are they going to have to do? Bow. Are they going to be happy about it? No. Are they going to do it? Yes. So Isaac is playing out Messiah's role that when he comes back and he's fruitful and multiplying and blessed by God, what are the nations going to do? Bow. And this is symbolic of what's happening. This nation of Abimelech and Gerar are symbolically bowing. Pichol, the commander of his army, the nation shall learn war no more. What's he going to have to do? Bow. That's his job. You must bow. You are now, your army is not to fight. Your kingdom is not to fight. You do no harm to Isaac or to Messiah at all. You are now subservient to him. Get the picture? That's why we're reading the symbols. So that's a lesson that God wanted us to learn, amongst many lessons, about the three wells of the grave and the life. That look at what the nations who would have caused harm to Isaac, look how they're going to now treat him. So the nations who would have caused harm to Messiah, look how now they're going to treat him. And we can see how this is going to work in how the nations will respond to Messiah once they realize, you are greater than we are, you are more blessed than we are, and we can do nothing about it. Please be kind. It's essentially what they're going to be doing. They're going to bow. They're going to be subservient to him. So that's the lesson we want to get from this picture. God's plan for Messiah was to do that, or is to do that. So we expect it, we see it in Isaac's life, therefore that's what we'll see. Make sense so far? Okay. There's, and then of course, afterward, after this event, after the men leave, then they hear about the fourth well. What's the fourth well called? After this blessing, the Abimelech comes, he bows, they do make a feast together, he sends them back away, and then the servants come to Isaac. We've dug a well, we found a fourth well. What's he call it? Sheba, which he then ties the whole thing, Beersheba, which is oath of sevens. But what is the symbolic word for seven? What's the other word for seven? Shabbat, or which comes a word for rest. Seven is symbolic of rest. I'm finished. It's also to be complete. Or finish. I'm done. I did it. The My enemies have become my footstool, God. I've done it. I now finished. I'm at peace. I'm done. Hence the oath, the agreement of sevens. So that's where we expect the Messiah will follow the same pattern. After the fruitful multiply and grow and be prosperous, the nation will come to him and say, we are now subservient to you. And he will find, they will be subservient, and his servants will say, we're done. We're finished. Our work is done. The world's now subservient. You've completed it. Make sense? Yes, Alma.
So what was the name, or what was that well when Messiah was talking to the woman?
It wasn't this well.
But do you know where it was?
The location? It's Jacob's well. I don't know the location. I'm sorry. It couldn't be too far. It had to be in Israel proper. It had to be further north. Yeah, somewhere up. I don't know the name of it. It's not the same well. It's not the same well. But there are some symbols that are pulled from that well. And you can argue some details so that you can gather from here in this idea of wells in general and how the water is used. But it's not the same well as this one referred to. This one was, by the way, was dug by Isaac too, not Jacob. So Jacob would have dug the other well, and Isaac dug this one too. Yes.
Just kind of related to Alma's question, because they're saying they're in Sychar in Samaria. So where is that in relation to where these are?
Samaria would be through the blue. My little map here. You have Jerusalem about this spot. Samaria was technically a town, but also was eventually renamed like a metropolis area, which then became a name of a country. But the city of Samaria was a bit north, about there, not too far from Shechem. That's the city of where the city was where the northern tribes were all ruled, and they had their kings set there. Eventually, before the Romans showed up, Samaria grew, speaks of a region, and then of course a whole nation was then just nicknamed or called that because the Samaritans. It's just the whole region showed up. That's when then the other kings showed up and they divvied people up and. Diaspora happened, and the northern tribes were captured, and the new ones came in. They were all called Samaritans because they're a funky mix of everything imaginable. It's like here's a shuffle cards of like 52 decks and pick up. Yeah, the ancient America, so to speak. Yes, it turned into that, and then of course it gets later on recut back down by the Romans. They rename it. I can't remember what they name it. Oh, maybe somebody else remember. I forgot. I don't remember. There are a lot of different names they gave the area or country, and they retitled its name. I don't know all the maps of where everything was, as far as where the well was. I do not know. Any questions so far regarding that? Okay. Let's move on. So, in my verses, they'll word this differently. But the tale in chapter 26 points out Esau was 40 years old. He took those wives, Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Basmat, the daughter of Elon, Hittite, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. The Hebrew word means, there means they were rebellious in spirit to Isaac and Rebekah. Now, it's not to say for certain, it doesn't know who's who in the Hebrew words. It doesn't necessarily mean that the two daughters were rebellious to Isaac and Rebekah. It could mean that in Isaac and Rebekah's feelings, they felt that they were being rebelled against with these two daughters. Either way, there's a rebellion going on there from either one side or the other as far as they're not liking each other. I take a wild stab at it. The two daughter-in-laws probably didn't agree with Isaac and Rebekah. Just a stab in the dark. Why would I say that? They're Hittites. Are they going to be honoring of the God of Abraham and Isaac? No, they're Hittites. What are the daughters going to be doing when they raise their kids? Raise their children about their pagan ways of the Hittites. Is any of that good in Isaac and Rebekah's eyes? No, it would be against them, hence the rebelling. The other philosophy is that the two women were actually antagonizing or greatly, openly, overtly against Isaac and Rebekah, which could be too, but we don't know. Yes.
I'm just curious because of the way that how Isaac's wife was chosen, and they're both 40. Obviously, their marriages are relatively soon or, close. But could that be why of the competition because of how Rebekah was chosen as opposed to there's no explanation of how Esau's wives were chosen?
It could be the process of chosen. I think it's the fact that who got chosen is the biggest thing. Because when Esau realizes that Jacob sent off back to the hometown of way back where, Esau realizes, oh, they must not like my wives. So I'm going to go choose somebody better, which is Ishmael's daughter, to go marry her. That it has to do with the person chosen that was actually selected. I'm speculating, because Hebrews doesn't explicitly state so, implies that Esau was a fornicator and what's the other word it uses? I read that. Profane. Profane means godless. So, sleeping around a godless man was Esau's track record, history, what he liked to do. I'm speculating those two women probably were products of that. Probably. Or somehow related with that or enjoyed that type of lifestyle. He married two wives and Isaac, of course, didn't. Neither did. Well, Abraham did sort of eventually. He got remarried. It's not, nothing wrong with the marriage of multiple wives this time in history. It still was both of when he chose were not necessarily good women to choose. So it could be the way which he was chosen or the people themselves chosen. My personal opinion, the women themselves weren't very good. That's my opinion. Because if they were good people, regardless how they were chosen, Rebecca wouldn't have an issue with them. They'd be okay. They were decent women, that's okay. If they were undecent women, she probably had an issue. Hence, she expresses her issue. What good? I'd rather be dead. I'd rather be dead than have Jacob in it with one of these women also. That's a big deal for a mother to say. I'd rather be dead than have him marry one of these types of women. Yes.
Well, the point was to upset his father, and especially Rebecca. Uh-huh. They didn't get along.
Right.
So it was like, where can I find the most unclean, filthy woman to bring home as my wife, which would be her grandkids?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. It was an old country song. What was that? There's a phrase, a cocktail waitress in a Dolly Parton wig was one of the phrases. I don't remember of the song. It's like a type of girl that this guy likes. I don't know what these women look like, but the type of person they were not honorable people, apparently, according to Rebecca's standards, which I don't think were unreasonable. Any other questions regarding so far as far as their women choices? Okay, so let's erase this. I got other things to talk about before my time is up. The blessing itself.
Like bringing home
Martin
Cyrus.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, look, Mom. Yeah, that's Miley Cyrus. Yeah, the type of person. I'm not against her necessarily, just an example you're using. I understand. Okay, let's move forward. So he realized that the two wives he selected were not acceptable. By the way, he's 40 years old. That, since he's twins, that means Jacob is at least 40 years old at this moment in time. He could be older because this could be a reference like he happened a couple years back. We don't know. But Jacob has to be at least the same age as Esau. So we're looking at 40 plus years old at the time which she complains to Isaac saying, don't let Jacob marry one of the women here locally. So Jacob and Esau have to be at least 40 when this event is occurring. Okay, so let's move forward. It says Isaac became old, couldn't see very well, obviously very poorly. And of course wants to bless Esau. Now points out that Isaac loved Esau and Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, God says he loved Jacob and Esau he hated or disliked or didn't want. Now, in the case of Isaac and Rebekah, it doesn't say that Rebekah hated Esau. It doesn't say that Isaac hated Jacob. It's just that Isaac loved Esau means he preferred Esau and Rebekah preferred Jacob. Rebekah, I'm sure, still loved Esau, her son. Maybe not as much, I don't know. I'm sure Isaac still loved his other son, Jacob. Maybe not as much, I don't know. But they preferred the individuals. So just as God chose individuals, Isaac and Rebekah chose individuals. Isaac's choice was, I guess, less discerning. I don't know. Or maybe Esau was a good liar. That could be too. So Isaac wanted or selected Esau. And Rebekah, of course, hears it. Yeah, hunter. Exactly. Very strong individual. All of which... Was Isaac a robust, strong individual? Maybe. Probably pretty good size, though. I say Isaac was probably a pretty good sized man as far as physical size. I say that because Esau was a strong man's hunter. But look what Jacob does. We didn't read that yet. He goes to Padan Aram, to Laban's house, Laban's territory. And he sees this pretty girl coming with the flocks. Now, the stones they used to cover wells usually required more than one man to do it. They didn't want one man to uncover it. That was the point. They wanted many people to be able to, so you would all the flocks would feed the well at the same time. They would all drink. But what does he do to impress the girl? He takes the well stone and tosses it, moves it aside, and he shows how strong he is. Well, he can't be a small man and do that. So most likely Jacob and Esau were of similar physical structure build, because moving a large stone that requires at least two men to do, you can't be the weakest person on earth to do that. You have to be a pretty strong guy to do it. So they're pretty good size in their physical stature. Rebecca, however, chose Jacob. Now, there are probably a lot of reasons why, most likely the prophecy that she heard from God saying Jacob's going to rule the older one. That's why she chose Jacob. And Esau, I'm suspecting that Isaac knew, but I don't know for certain, that Jacob was supposed to be chosen, supposed to be blessed after Esau was blessed. Or, sorry, not supposed to be. Take it back. Say again. Isaac probably knew, I spoke incorrectly. Isaac probably knew that Jacob was supposed to rule over Esau. He probably knew that. I don't know when, but he probably knew it. He just didn't like it. He liked Esau's scenario first. I say Isaac probably knew because look at Isaac's reaction when Esau comes in. Let's look real closely at what he says there. When Esau comes in, it's, verse 33 first. Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came. I have blessed him, and indeed he should be blessed." Now, I see the word trembled exceedingly. That's an important phrase. Because when someone trembles exceedingly, they know, I've done something wrong. You're not trembling exceedingly because somebody else did something wrong. Because you did something wrong. Now, God is nicknamed the fear of Isaac. He's called that. He's the friend of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, the love of Jacob. Those are his different titles he uses. What would make Isaac tremble exceedingly? What's the one thing he's afraid of? God. Opposing God's will. Going against him. That's one thing that would make him tremble exceedingly, in my opinion. Now, I use that as a result. If he trembled exceedingly, and God's called the fear of Isaac, that's the one thing he's going to fear, that's God, and the biggest thing that fears God. What's he trembling about? He knows he was trying to go against what God wanted, or God intended. That's why, in my personal opinion, I think Isaac knew about the prophecy regarding the two boys when Rebecca was still pregnant. I think he heard about it, or she probably explained it to him. I don't know when or how, but it probably occurred. And his endeavor to bless Esau was going against that blessing. And then he realized it didn't work. I did something, I tried to pull something off, it didn't work. And I got caught. Didn't like it. It was trembled exceedingly. So now he's stuck. Now I got to just mend the issue. Here's your secondary, you know, blessing. It's not so great, but better than nothing. And moves on from there. So in my opinion, because of the issue of why Rebecca knew that Jacob was going to be chosen over Esau, it's why she loved him. But one of the things about Jacob, what was his characteristic trait? He stayed home. He stayed home among the tents, among the territory, among the land where he was at. Note, previously, Isaac got a chance to stay in one spot in near Gerar and actually sow a field and grow crops. Now, Abraham didn't do that, but Isaac did, because it's the land that was important to God. He wanted these people to get blessed and produce in this land. What's the difference between farmers and ranchers back at this time, or also called nomads? Do nomads stay in one spot? No, they're nomadic. They move. Which Abraham and Isaac all were, and even Jacob was for many years. They're nomads. What do farmers do? Settlers do. They stay in one spot and plant crops, and they, for years and years and years and years, and grow that, and they prosper where they're at. So the difference between Isaac and Abraham was that Isaac was developing this whole crop-building concept. And of course, Jacob, he does sheep mostly, but also develops this crop-growing concept later on as well, in different ways. So Jacob is a homebody, a farmer, so we call him a settler, style person. Contrast that to Esau. What's he? a hunter. Do hunters stay home? The hunters, no, they don't. What do? They follow the game. Where's the game travel? Wherever. And those of you who have hunters in your family, when they go hunt, they go to your backyard and start shooting things? Where do they go? The neighbors are shooting. They usually go up into the hill country, up into the woods or somewhere else where there's lots of property, or the duck ponds or wherever. They're leaving all the time. Yes, Tim.
That explains why Esau's wives made Rebekah and Isaac so miserable. Because when Esau is gone, going hunting and this and that, it's highly unlikely the wives would have gone with him. So Isaac and Rebekah are stuck with these women who have their foreign ways, their foreign gods.
Yep.
And Esau's not there to mediate and maybe keep them entertained and keep them away.
Good point. That's a good point. I didn't think about that. That's right. Esau's is a hunter, so his wives are stuck at home making his parents miserable. Exactly. Chris is choosing like an am. Okay. Let's move forward here. Okay, so there's a difference between these two. Rebecca preferred this style of Jacob, the settler style, versus Isaac's preferring of Esau, the hunter. Of course, the hunter is always gone. God chose Jacob, so apparently he preferred or agreed, I should say, with Rebecca. So God selected this group of individuals to prosper, along with Rebecca's choice. Maybe she was more discerning. I don't really know. Either way, let's see here. I'm going to point something out to you, though. In chapter 28, by the way, first of all, are there any questions regarding how the blessing took place between Esau and Jacob? It's pretty straightforward. It's kind of obvious what happened. The story explains it pretty thoroughly. Any comments or questions regarding that? Because I'm going to bypass that and move on. Yes, go ahead.
I mean, I think I get the basic principle, but I'm kind of confused. You know, there's the birthright,
yep.
The blessing,
yep.
The inheritance. Mm-hmm. If you could just kind of rehash how that all...
I'll do my best, okay?
Thank you.
I'll erase this real quick. Now, I'm not an expert in this category, but I'll do what I can. So, in a given family, you have property, and you may have multiple sons. It's normally divided up with sons. If there are no sons, divided with just daughters. The reason they're usually divided up with daughters is because daughters usually marry, and then that property would then travel to whoever their husband is, and they'd prefer not to do that. They prefer to keep it the sons, because the sons don't travel with their new husband, well, unless they're in California. They travel with their daughters when they marry. So property is divided up. As I mentioned before, let's say you have three sons. Well, make this life simpler. We'll just say there's two sons, because that's really who we're dealing with now. So there's Esau and Jacob. I realize they're only minutes apart, but Esau's the older. So in Isaac's property, the birthright, which includes the property rights, is Esau gets 2/3 and Jacob gets 1/3. That's what's broken up. Because Esau must get a double portion than whatever his siblings get. Okay? If there are many siblings, you'd have to add them all up and say, okay, plus one. So let's say I've got 7 siblings. I would make my property into 8 equal parts. Alright? And Esau would get 2 of those parts, and each other child would get just 1 of them. So Esau then would get an eighth. So it's 1/4. And then Jacob and everybody else, we get 1/8 and all the way down. Alright? So they all have to get, the first one gets double. Now, along with property is the more obscure concept of birthright. Because property is obvious, you can see, you can divvy it up. This property is this much, it's worth so many dollars. Divide it all out. Along with property, there's one other thing he also gets as a birthright, is the physical land. The land is a separate thing than your money. You may have 1,000 sheep. Okay, divvy this out accordingly. If you have a 5-acre plot of land, that goes to the firstborn son. It doesn't matter what the land's worth. It's regardless of that. It goes first, but it has to stay in the family undivided up as one solid unit. Okay? That always goes to the firstborn as well. So you actually get double the physical property, But he also gets all the land as well. So this is all the property definitions. Birthright's thing is slightly similar but slightly different. And the idea of birthright, it is authority. Okay? So property is one thing, but birthright is authority.
Is it AU?
Authority. So that, let's say there's a quarrel or disagreement between any of the siblings. Esau settles the fight. If Esau says, hey, sibling number 7, 8, 12, whoever you are, you are going to go over there and do XYZ task. That sibling says, yes, sir, and goes and does it. See, the authority is also attached to birthright. That's where the birthright comes. It's the authority that Esau receives, that he can rule over his brothers, how many brothers he has. He can tell them what to do, and they'll go do it, because that is the birthright tradition, kind of birthright, independent of actual physical property. Does that make sense? Okay. Independent of the birthright and property is the blessing. So blessing over here, right over here. Blessing can be broken up in multiple different ways. The blessings are usually divided up between the firstborn son gets a grander blessing than everybody else. However, blessings are usually tailored to the person themselves. So if I have a good son, I will give him a good blessing. If I have a bad son, I may not. I won't say bad blessing to anybody, but I may not. Blessings are something slightly different. So if you have multiple sons, I'll draw this up differently. So I have Esau over here, Jacob, and, do one too many. So Esau and Jacob, I can now choose to bless them. Now as the firstborn, Esau's blessing should be matching or similar to what his authority was as a birthright, as well as his property rights. The blessing should follow along the same line. So I've given you all this land, you have all this property, you have all the authority, may God bless you and prosper, make you big and wonderful, and all this great stuff. Rule over everybody. That's the theory behind the blessings. Now, what God did is God said, I'm changing this system. Esau, you actually don't get to keep the property long term because they're kicking you out. The money you get to keep, but the land you don't. The authority, I'm taking away from you, Esau. You don't get that either. Because Esau sold his birthright. So the property rights, meaning Esau, when he sold to Jacob, he sold his property rights. So the land, as well as the 2/3 property Esau agreed to sell to Jacob. That's the physical cons of what he was selling. So Jacob has the land plus 2/3. That was the agreement. Giving Esau 1/3 and no land. That was what the birthright physically means. But it also means, which is what Jacob was more after, the authority to rule over. Esau sold that too with the birthright. So now, Jacob not only got the land and the 2/3. Now, whether he physically received it or not, doesn't matter. The point is the idea behind it, that the symbolism behind it. So the symbols behind it, Jacob now also received the authority to rule over or control what Esau does for a bowl of stew. That's an awful lot of power for some food. Right? That's a big deal. But Esau, the birthright, wasn't worth anything. It didn't matter to him. Now, I mentioned earlier, there's the spiritual meaning of it too. The God aspect of it. Because along this lines of the firstborn son, God was supposed to follow along that too. Because of who the men were. There was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God was supposed to follow along to Abraham, Isaac, Esau, and all the other subsequent firstborn sons. That was the theory. But God's saying, with this whole birthright sale, God went with Jacob instead of Esau. Now, of course, God already preset that. He told Rebecca ahead of time, they're not even born yet. I'm choosing him anyway. But this is when this event, this birthright sale, that's what it occurred. As far as between the two boys. Well, I shouldn't call them boys. They were men. Between the two, both men. So that was what got transferred. Esau didn't care for it. It didn't matter to him. Why? Well, think about it. What did he like to do? He was a hunter. Does he need flocks and does he need herds? Does he need... No. Doesn't need land. Everything's free. go you bow your sword and go hunt something. What was valuable to him? That. So is any of this other stuff valuable? No, he didn't care. So it didn't matter to him. But, I feel like it's old, and he's like, hey, I really wanted that after all. Yeah. Once the kid starts saying, Daddy, I'm hungry, he's like, I have 12 of you. How do I feed all you? That's when hunting's a little more work. But too late. He wasn't thinking about it. He was a young man thinking about his own issues. So there's the details what he received, the birthrights. The blessing should have followed. Oh, yes, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say it. It all makes sense now after you put that and you explained it, because if you go back to the blessing that Isaac was giving Jacob, if it would have been Esau...
It would make sense.
it would have been bad because he's blessing Esau to have all this land and to prosper and to grow many fruit, but he's got no land.
Right.
He already gave that away. So it's like almost a wasted blessing. And then Rebecca, you know, tricking him to Jacob, actually got the blessing. He had the land.
Yep.
And it all just seemed to work out perfectly.
It did work out well. And that's the way it was designed to be. We can pinpoint, say, Rebecca, you did something wrong. You tried to trick your husband, blah, blah, blah. Reality is, God set this, and God knew ahead of time what was going to happen. I'm not saying everything's preordained. The point is that God had a plan to make the events, random stuff, all work together to make his plan work. And he chose Rebecca, the unwilling Jacob, to all go through with it. Yes?
Well, we also know that in some ways Rebecca probably saved Isaac's life, because we know what God does to people who double-cross him sometimes.
Yes, we do. He doesn't like rebellion at all. God doesn't take kindly to rebellion. Okay, so now the blessing kind of makes sense then too, then, right? So the blessing, which was supposed to go to the one who has all the stuff, went instead, of course, to Jacob. Now, once you give all that stuff to Jacob, what do you get the rest of the kids? Pat him back, say, good luck. Essentially what you got. Yeah, good hunting. Enjoy what you can do, because you're going to make your living the hard way. The firstborn gets everything. That's kind of what's left over. So Isaac is in the situation. He has two sons. And the firstborn didn't get the blessing. The secondborn did. The firstborn has to get something now. Of course, that's what he gives, the blessing. You'll fight the land. You'll be fighting. You'll be all this stuff, but you'll try to make your way and work, eke out your own living, which fit Esau's personality well. Kind of man he was. He was a hunter. He liked to eke out his own living by physical, you know, go kill, go take. I'm not saying Esau was an evil man, which some people argue he was an evil person. He wasn't evil. He was just a man. There are many men like that. But Jacob received the blessing that corresponded to a firstborn son. Yes?
Well, if Jacob had the direction to go to Laban and get a wife there, and that, and he was there, you know, 14 years, 7, and then 7, and he really pretty much made his land there and everything. Esau was the one back home, wasn't he? Doing the fielding and doing the
doing
work
stuff,
there, right?
Whatever he was. Well, they have many, many servants, by the way. Isaac and Rebekah had many people working for them. So I'm not sure how much work Esau actually physically did, or his three wives wind up actually doing, I don't know. But he may have got to use the land some. It's hard to say. It's hard to say what all Esau was doing while Jacob was out. When Jacob came back, Esau has tons and tons of property, meaning not physical lands, but in physical livestock. So he has lots of stuff. So Esau apparently inherited, or at least received, an awful lot from his dad. I don't know how much, but at least a large percentage of it. So much he didn't need anymore. Okay, so that explains the blessings then. Any questions regarding how that process worked? Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Let's see. We are at... Oh, right. Back to your comment there, Anne. Regarding the whole go find a wife. No, she didn't say that to Esau, did she? She didn't say, Esau, when he was, you know, a young man, wherever, how old he was, go find a wife in Padan Aram or anywhere else. She allowed him to grow up and choose whatever wife he wanted. This whole idea of Jacob locating a wife from Padan Aram rather than the local wives was probably, at least partially, intended, as it explains it was to get Isaac to agree to get Jacob out, to get him out of the area so Esau wouldn't kill him. Now, Esau doesn't know how many years will go by before Isaac dies. Obviously, it was many. But still, to get him out of the way, and this issue about go finding a wife back in Padan Aram was probably partially to make sure that Esau and Jacob were divided, separated out, to grow and prosper in their own independent ways. Because, of course, Jacob would be killed if he stuck around when Isaac died. Let's see here. So Isaac gave, back in 28, verse 6. Esau saw that Isaac blessed Jacob and sent him away to put on Aram to take himself a wife from there. That he blessed him and gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. But Jacob obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to put on Aram. So Esau is the observer in this case. So Esau's watching Jacob's actions and what his father is saying to telling him to do, and seeing how he is being blessed. Then Esau realizes or sees the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. Now note, Esau's big thing was that he was loved by Isaac and not so much by his mom. Of course, the wives he chose, hey mom, look who I found, dragged up from the ditch. here are these. Was he concerned about his mother's liking of the wives? Probably not, because he wasn't really too concerned about his mom's thoughts or opinions at all. Well, in this case, he realized that, oh, but dad doesn't like the wives. Oh, okay, dad, what do you want me to do? So he goes up and finds to Ishmael, takes Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, Sitobath, and to be his wife, in addition to the wives he already had. So he realized once the wives are not acceptable to his father, too, and then he said, oh, now I'll do something about it. I'll go find somebody who's better. Of course, now he's stuck with three, and I'm not sure how good any of them were. But he's stuck with three wives. But this whole process of this story, which I'm going to conclude with this for today, this whole process of the story is to point out the distinction between God choosing Jacob versus choosing Esau. That's really the objective of our story, this whole process. It's the idea of God choosing. So God choosing also referred to electing or selecting. So God's selecting process, is it based on their actions? No. Is it based on their feelings? No. Is it based on who their parents were? No. Is it based on their history at all? No. What is God's selecting process based on? His own authority, his own will. I'm choosing this versus that. It should tell us that, which is consistent, the actions aren't the key that God says, oh, I like you today. Oh, what a good boy, I'll now choose you. What a good girl, I'll now choose you. That's not the point. God's choosing is based on, I want this to happen versus I want that to happen. And what do we do about it? Nothing. Because the pottery doesn't get to ask the potter, why'd you make me for this? It just says, okay, I will do this. I will do that as exactly as you instructed me to, because that's what you designed me to do. The actions, your free will, comes in as Esau, who he points out here, he observed and saw something. Oh, I should change what I'm doing. I should try to move forward and make a correction. That's where your free will comes in. God may have built you for one thing. When it comes to your free will, it's called open your eyes and look. Look around you. Pay attention. See what God's will is doing and how it's working out for you. How'd your life turn out? Oh, look, I'm Esau. Not so good. Well, why did I not turn out so good? Well, maybe you should look at your actions and go backwards and take a look and observe your past where you came from and see where you got here today and say, oh, now I get it. You have the ability, we all have the ability to look back and say, hey, God brought me to this point, this is where I'm at, and it's a compilation of all the things I've been doing. How'd they turn out? Well, in Esau's case, not so well. What was his free will, his actions, what were they based on? His own personal desires. I want this one, I want that one. I want this, I don't want that. Yes?
Well, I was going to say God chooses based on the heart when what he sees on people's hearts. That's
when he sees a person's heart, they can change how they're traveling. You notice when it says David is a man after God's own heart. Now, David is a young boy, he's a relatively young boy, but still a man after God's own heart. Well, what did David do? A lot of things. Mostly good, but he did some bad things too. Really bad things. But his actions was not the dominant thing from God with David. It was what David, what his intent was, where he was leading, because God's will was going to follow through. Now, David had the ability, as well as his sons too, to observe, look, and change if they can, before, as Esau ran into, before your time runs out. If we wait to the very end, nothing left to change. It's done. You got caught, as Jeff pointed out earlier. Yes.
Something I hadn't really noticed before, but just reading it all at once today, I saw a possible prophetic parallel between the Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob and Esau and the first and second Adam. Just because, you know, they're the son of the flesh, which Adam was made from the dust,
right.
And then Messiah became the second Adam when he rose from the dead in his spirit body. Jacob and Isaac were the sons that were given the promise. So it's kind of like, you know, the son of the spirit, kind of how Paul describes. So I just hadn't really seen that parallel before today.
Which is consistent with what God, which was God's, his symbol all along. This whole idea of choosing somebody and selecting a process, it really is of, okay, here is what I have, but here's where I have attained to. Where I've gone from this flesh, from this world around me. Where am I going to? Where is my destination traveling? Well, that's the spiritual selection. When you went through, you pointed out correctly, when you go through with Adam and with Messiah, Messiah obviously was a descendant. Clearly, he had the sense all the way through. You can trace back from Adam all the way on. He was obviously a child, but he was greater. So the descendancy is not to descend as in going downward, but rather to go and eventually to go upward, to move forward a positive direction. And that was God's, in my opinion, his selecting process was designed to do that throughout the whole storyline. When God selected Abel versus Cain, and of course, he's on through Seth's line, and he chooses Noah. He goes through the process of selecting these individual people, not because there's necessarily something great about them. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. But God chose them, and they went, or they elevated or attained something greater than what they would have had God not chosen them. That's an important thing. The choosing selection, because what do we all want the choosing to result in? Life. That we live. We want to be chosen. Yes.
Which is also one of the distinctions between the clean and unclean.
Yes.
Stuff in the clean category may not be necessarily so great, and stuff in the unclean category, you know, people try to make all kinds of justifications for why something is unclean, but in a lot of cases it's arbitrary. And
right.
God is just simply saying, this is clean, this is unclean.
Not. Yep.
If you want to be on my good side, this is what I say is clean.
Yep.
And in a sense, why would he do that? In a world that many people say is just nothing but a sea of gray, it is a distinction where you say, there are some things that is good, there are some things that are profitable, there are some things that are bad, and there are some things that are unprofitable. So look at the things that are on the good, the profitable side that the creator of everything is wanting you to go down, and go that way.
That's the route he wanted us to take. And the beautiful thing about this is that he wrote a book for us for to read all these stories in. So we can see the results and see where things lead. As a result, we had the ability to say, okay, I don't want to live like Ahab's or the Esau's or the Ishmael's of the world. I want a better blessing than that. So observe and follow. It's hard for most of us who are naturally rebellious, but still, try, succeed if you can, observe and follow. It's observation. It's watching and trying to move forward. Does that make sense? So that's the goal, one of the main things I want you to get out of Esau and Jacob's story. These are two different men who chose two different, very different lives. But they were chosen for their paths before they were even born. They had their lives they were going to be set in doing. All the reasons why I couldn't tell you, but God selected, and God's will was always going to get done, regardless of what the men actually ended up being like. Any questions or comments? All right, we're going to conclude with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this Shabbat, our day of rest. Father, we ask you to bless us with kindness, with mercy, with patience, abundance of patience, with one another and with you and with all the things around us. Father, please help us to be strong. Help us to observe and watch the path that we are on and where we came from. May our path always lead according to your will, according to your promise, according to your agreements, that we may receive your life. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L dot I-N-F-O. Hallel.info.